Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry. I'm broadcasting from the studio of KALW 91.7, San Francisco's oldest and most innovative public radio station.
And I'm coming to you from Canberra, Australia, one last time, from the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. It's another cold, chilly winter morning here in Canberra, John. I hope you're having a good day there.
Oh, it's great in San Francisco. Beautiful as always. But I've heard that Canberra is a beautiful city, too. Ken, are you enjoying the beauty?
Well, Canberra, a beautiful city. It's full of beautiful philosophical minds. It's a hotbed of philosophy. It's also full of politicians, so it's a hotbed of hot air, you know. And it's 5 o'clock in the morning here, so my mind's a little slow this morning. So take it easy on me, guy, okay?
Well, you know, you think therefore you're awake or something like that. So Australia, San Francisco, Philosophy Talk coming at you from all over the world. And you can also check out our website, philosophytalk.org.
So, John, so we're going to talk about René Descartes today, and he's supposed to be one of the great philosophers of all time, one of the intellectual fathers of the scientific revolution. I mean, so what makes him such a big deal? Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, I mean, there are great things about René Descartes' career that put him up there with Newton and Galileo as a founder of the scientific revolution. We all learn Cartesian coordinate geometry in school and so forth. But philosophically, it's really a change of pace, because philosophically, Descartes is most known for the problem of subjectivity. What's subjectivity? Well, we're all conscious. We all have thoughts and ideas that we're aware of in our own minds. And that was Descartes' starting point. He said, how do I know that there's more to the world than that?
Yeah,
How do I know that there's an external world that I'm perceiving, and not just it's not just an illusion or some evil demon fooling me? And that really grabbed people's interest.
Yeah, and you're right, it grabbed people's interest. I think of it as a trap, though. I think Descartes says this starts with a problem of subjectivity, right? I start out knowing my own mind and the content of my own mind. You know, I've got these ideas in there. I've got ideas of tables and chairs and God and my body. I've got all these ideas, and that's the first thing I know. But there's a problem. Are any of these ideas, like, do they have any reference to anything outside of me? Is there really a God? Is there really a table? Is there really a chair? Is there really my body? Are you really out there, John? And, you know, he got us in this trap, but I don't think it's not clear to me he gave us any way to get out of it. And you know, and ever since, people have been wondering, is there a God? Is there an external world? Is there a body?
Well, wonder is great, because wonder is what makes philosophy possible. Don't think of it as a trap or a problem. Think of it as the opportunity of subjectivity, the opportunity that thinking about our own thought and our own existence gives us to think about and understand the rest of the world in a new way. I don't know whether ordinary people are bothered by this, but philosophy students glom onto it right away, and Descartes is very influential.
That's true. Let's find out if some ordinary people are gripped by this. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, out on a mission. She files this report.
What do you know? Or what do you think you know, and how do you know it? Are you sure you exist? Why?
Well, I guess I do tend to believe what I see and what I've learned through my direct experience, and somehow in the end we know what's a dream and what's not, although I'm not sure how.
You don't, yeah, you don't. I mean, I think you just have to take things for what they are and just, you know, leave it at that. Because you're never, if you think about it that way, you're going to question everything that you know. I feel like, I think it would be exhausting to think that way all day, to be honest with you.
Well, I know I exist. Whether this is all that is me, I don't know. It's true that I know that I exist, but whether this is it or not, I don't know. And whether I'm just somebody's thought thinking I exist, I don't know.
There are some things that I think are beyond our reason yet are true. I mean, I sort of believe in the basic goodness of people and the connectedness of things in some very general way, but I, you know, it's something that seems right to me and feels right to me, and I'm willing to live my life based around, but I couldn't prove it.
Existence is not that clearly defined. It's not that black and white in my experience.
You know, you have to trust your experiences and your senses to tell you what you know is true, but I know also, having been in the military and been a in the backseat of fighters that your senses can lie to you, and you have to trust what your instruments are telling you. For instance, if you're turning hard to the left when you straighten out, your senses tell you you're turning hard to the right. You train yourself not to pay attention to it. Train yourself to look at your instruments and believe what they're saying.
I mean, is reality a delusion, or is it what we think it is, you know? And is our thinking the bottom line of reality, or is our thinking just one of the many prismatic, changeable illusions about reality, if there is, in fact, reality?
This is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Amy. I'm John Perry, and with me telephonically, at least according to my sense impressions and consciousness, is the co-host of this show, Ken Taylor.
Yeah, we're going to be joined in a second by Professor Ronald Rubin, who's in the Department of the History of Ideas at Pitzer College. He's the author of A Guided Tour of René Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy. Ron, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken. Hi, John.
Hi, Ron. Glad to have you here on Philosophy Talk. Let's start off with this cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. What in the world got Descartes into a frame of mind where he had to prove his own existence? And what was there about his times, his intellectual times, that made anyone care? It sounds all kind of crazy.
Well, my belief is that he doesn't use cogito ergo sum actually to prove his own existence. He thinks that his own existence is intuitive. He thinks that he knows that he exists in the same way that he knows that 2 + 3 = 4. I'm sorry that 2 + 3 is 5.
Oh, yeah, he knows that.
Skeptical mistake. Yeah. A little skeptical mistake.
Yeah. You're trying to keep us on our toes there, Ron.
But why is this what's he up to? I mean, why does he need to assert it? Even if he's not trying to approve it, why does he need to assert it? What's the point of all this?
Well, this does have to do with his times. His times are times when people are questioning received opinions about science, about religion, about politics. And he engages in extreme doubt. Cogito ergo sum is a way to solve those doubts. His own existence is the solid point on which he hopes to build a certain and stable foundation for knowledge.
So, and he thinks that hasn't been done until now, that knowledge has not been on a stable and certain foundation, and he's going to, like, give it a foundation anew or something like that? I mean, is that what
he's up to? That is what he thinks. That is what he thinks. The science of his day, the science in which he himself was trained, was Aristotelian, and almost all of that has been taken away, but during Descartes' lifetime not replaced. So he looks back and sees this mass destruction of academic belief and thinks that something went wrong and he's going to fix it. But when he looks back, he thinks that this hasn't happened to mathematics, so he tries to build a system that has the same structure as a mathematical system.
So Ron, the meditations, which I guess he doesn't say cogito ergo sum in the meditations, but it's the...
He doesn't.
I mean, who the fool didn't use his most famous line in his most famous book? He needed a better press agent.
Right. Yeah.
This is in the second meditation, though, where he would have said it, where his own existence comes up. In the first meditation, he has managed to convince himself that he doesn't know all sorts of things. And this is where the famous dream thing comes up. Am I dreaming? Is all this stuff that seems to be real just part of a dream? Do you think that really bothered Descartes? Was that a sincere worry that he had?
It was a sincere worry, but the worry wasn't quite that he didn't know anything. It was that the things that he knew were not certain. He holds these beliefs, he thinks they're true, but he's afraid that someplace down the line they will be overthrown.
Yeah.
So he resolves not to assert certain things because he's not certain of them. It's not that he doesn't believe them. It's not that he doesn't know them.
Right. So, no, okay, look, let's just get clear. So he's in this quest for certainty, right? He's in this quest for certainty because he wants the intellectual kind of thing to start over again, because everything that was handed down, the science of the past, all that stuff, the politics of the past, it's all crumbling, right? And he wants to start over again. And that's why we're talking, that's why this is the time that people call the scientific revolution, right? Because it's all about the change. It's all the old structures are about to go away. And Descartes wants them to be lasting. And he thinks if they're to be lasting, they've got to be based on, what, certain foundations that are in some ways, what, impregnable, can't be overthrown, like the foundations of the past.
Yeah, that's right.
Have I got that right so far?
He wants everything to be. He wants everything to be as certain as 2 + 2 = 4. Everything as certain as mathematics. Is that the idea?
He wants things to be more certain than mathematics. He admires mathematical method, but in Meditation 1, he actually calls mathematics into doubt.
Right. Wow. This is quite an ambition.
So what's it got to do? I still don't see what this has to do with the cogito. John asked you, what's the cogito got to do with all this stuff? Why does he need to prove that? And you said he doesn't need to prove that, but somehow we were illustrating what the point of this cogito ergo sum business is. And we got talking about all this scientific crumbling and rebuilding. So I still don't see how does the cogito fit in here?
Well, as I think John pointed out earlier, the way that Descartes raises doubts in Meditation 1 is by thinking up various hypotheses. And in Meditation 1, he can't quite rule them out. He doesn't believe that they're true. He doesn't even think there's any real probability that they're true, but he can't quite rule them out. And the hypotheses cause him to have doubts about his beliefs. There's the hypothesis, roughly speaking, that he might be dreaming all of the time, dreaming the world. And then there's another hypothesis, which is that his mind is so poorly designed that the things that seem most obviously true to him are in fact false. Things such as 2 + 3 = 5. Hey, I got it right that time.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So your mind isn't so bad after all, Aaron.
No.
So.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay. So he thinks, he calls all of his beliefs into doubt in Meditation 1, and then he says, is there anything that has been immune to that doubt? And what he notices is that all of the hypotheses that he's used to create doubt, in fact, entail that he exists. If he's dreaming, then he must exist. If his mind is so poorly designed that he doesn't see things correctly, then he must exist. So he notices that I am is immune to all the doubt that he's raised in Meditation 1.
Okay, right. So I see in that context this is a big deal. In the first meditation, he manages to doubt everything, and at the beginning of the second meditation, he comes up to one thing he can't doubt, I exist. But by the end of the book, he must get everything back. He must believe in the moon and the sun and mathematics and the earth and his girlfriends. What are the big steps on the way to getting it all back?
That's a big question, John. We're going to have to take that up, in stages. That's not a one-time thing. But we're getting close. We got the problem, right?
Yeah.
We're looking for something absolutely certain and more certain than even mathematics. And
that's
if
right.
We find this absolutely certain thing, somehow we're going to build all the foundations of knowledge on that, right? I mean, this one
that's
absolutely
right.
certain thing.
Well, give us a next step. I got that I exist. What's the next thing I can figure out for absolute certain?
The next step's a very large one, because Descartes moves directly from I exist to God exists.
Oh, my God. I mean, oh, my gosh. I mean, I guess oh, my God is appropriate. So before he gets to the moon, he gets to God?
That's right.
Isn't that a little odd?
We'll
discuss the oddness of Descartes' reinstitution of knowledge based on the fact that the knowledge of God is more certain than the knowledge of the moon when philosophy talk continues after this break.
When I say René Descartes, what do you think of first? What is it? Is there anything in particular that comes to mind?
No, not really.
What if I said to you, I think therefore I am?
Okay, now it's making a little more sense.
Now what does I think therefore I am mean to you?
Getting to the idea of consciousness and the fact that if you are self-aware, you are more human.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is René Descartes. Our guest is Ronald Rubin from Pitzer College.
I'm Ken Taylor here with my colleague John Perry. Do you ever get gripped by Cartesian doubt? Do you wonder? Do you ever really wonder whether there's a world out there or just you or you alone? Some of our listeners obviously do from our roving reporter. Tell us what you think. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Ron, I want to go back a step before we get into God and all that. Just a second. I just want to be clear about this Cartesian method of doubt and whether any sane person really should ever live their life this way, right? So he says, you know, I'm going to doubt everything. I'm going to doubt even some things that might turn out to be true. And the reason is because I'm going to tell myself these stories, right? So here's the question he asks himself. I believe something, but is there any way I can tell myself a story so that although I do believe it, like I believe I have a hand, can I tell myself a story in which I'm believing it falsely, even though I do believe it? And if I can tell myself a story, I'll assume it's false, right? So I can get this certain thing. But, I mean, what kind of method is that to just subject everything to doubt, even possibly true things? Isn't that going to end up throwing out a lot of truth? And should anybody ever, like, live their life that way? Say, doubt everything. If it at all can be doubted, take it to be false. Should anybody ever live their life that way?
I don't think so. There are stories about Pyrrho, the ancient Greek skeptic, living his life that way, and it was not a pleasant life. He would, for example, walk off of ships not believing that he would fall into the sea and his disciples would hold him back. But Descartes' point is not that anyone ought ever to live their life that way. It is that people should undertake this program of doubt once in their life. And in the Meditations, it's fairly clear that what he does is to set up a little retreat for himself, where he doesn't have to worry about life for just a very brief period.
See, now, I have to admit, I use this book, or I have to claim, I use this book, and I use your translation, every year to teach introductory philosophy. And that's exactly what I tell them. I said, look, college is really your little secluded place like Descartes had. College is a pretty carefree existence, hopefully. And you should actually maybe not spend too much time worrying about whether you exist, but you ought to subject the things you believe to systematic doubt, because where do we get most of our beliefs? From nowhere, from parents who are mostly miseducated slobs, from ministers who probably got into that line of work because they couldn't do anything else, from school teachers that aren't ignorant, from people on Fox TV that are complete idiots. So you ought to really subject all this stuff to doubt. I think Descartes was right.
What about the testimony of one's own eyes? He subjects the testimony of his own senses to doubt.
Well, you need to sharpen your skills, see, with that kind of thing. And then it ought to be a lifelong thing to just, you read something in the New York Times, doubt it. You read something in the Bible, doubt it. It's great. Don't you agree, Ron?
Yeah, I agree.
That was a question in there.
The world is not quite as it looks to us anyway, and we find this out. So there are occasions in which we know that our senses are not revealing the world properly to us.
You said he wants something even more certain than mathematics. Now, there's something that seems to me pretty well nigh indubitable, that 2 + 2 = 4. Could Descartes tell him a story in which, you know, 2 + 2 = 4? I mean, how could you doubt that?
Well, he says that's an intuitive truth. And what he means by that is that when the mind looks at it, it just sees its truth. We have no evidence for it. It's something whose truth is on the surface of it. Or seems to be on the surface of it. The way it gets called into doubt is by our imagining that our minds are misdesigned, that what seems true to us is in fact false. And in order to flesh that out, as it were, to make sense of that story, he thinks that he might be the product of an evil demon.
And what does this evil demon do? I mean, tell me about this
evil demon. The evil demon tries to deceive him as best he can. And so the evil demon makes his mind say, yes, that's true, when in fact the propositions before his mind are false.
Folks,
so
you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of René Descartes. Give us a call, 415-841-4134. Is there anything you've really believed and then you've come to see it's not true? Do you think the method of doubt can really help? 841-4134. Give us a call.
Or if you're outside the barrier, you can call 1-800-525-9917 or send us email at comments@philosophytalk.org. Could you live your life gripped by Cartesian doubt, or do you think he's just an overgrown adolescent who just calls everything into question and can't grow up?
There's nothing wrong with being an overgrown adolescent that can't grow up. Some of us have made a very nice life
of
it.
Yes, John. Well, I know.
Damon in San Jose, what have you got to say about all this?
Hi there. Well, as has been pointed out, Descartes wanted something more than mathematical certainty in philosophy, and so I think that as much as anything else shows that what he was trying to do was not encourage doubt, but to show that everything is as certain as we see it to be. So by subjecting everything to this acid of doubt, as someone called it, then what you wind up with is a world around you that doesn't need to be questioned because you know it's true. And so going out and saying, do I actually have a hand? You don't need to do that because Descartes did it for you.
Well, of course, he didn't know about my hand, but he kind of went through the major steps that I could go through, I guess. I would kind of boggle at the step where he proves the existence of God. I always thought that went a little fast for me.
That one was a little bit fast for me too.
We need to talk about that. I mean, thanks, Damon. Damon's absolutely right. Descartes was not, in the traditional sense, a skeptic. I mean, he did this skeptical exercise, but he was trying to establish certain foundations and then from there to build on them, to give you a way of systematically building on these certain foundations. So, I mean, Damon's absolutely right. But here's the question. Did he really do it, Ron? Did he really get us out of, you know, the trap of just, it's us and our ideas, you know? I mean, did he really succeed? And how did he propose to get us out of that apparent circle of subjectivity? I mean,
well, most people think that he didn't succeed, but the way that he tries to work his way out of this is by proving God's existence, and using God as a guarantee of the truth of what seems true to him. So the entire project rests, the success of the project rests on the success or failure of his proofs for God's existence.
So did they convince you, Ron, or is that a personal question?
It's a personal question, but I'll answer it. I think they're better arguments than most Descartes scholars think, but I don't find them absolutely convincing. They're sketches of arguments.
It's kind of, I don't know, do we want to go through Descartes' argument for he has actually two arguments for the existence of God. I'm going to give a 5-cent store version of one of them. So look, I got all these ideas in my head, right? And many of them, like my idea of a body or something, that could just be a fiction. That could just be an illusion. There are not any bodies out there. I have the idea. I think there are bodies, but there's no grounds for my believing that anything really answers to that idea. But my idea of God, for reasons that are kind of hard to explain, is such that it couldn't just be come from me, and it couldn't just be an illusion. There has to be something that answers to that idea out there. There has to be a God. Otherwise, I couldn't have this idea of God in my head. And the way the argument's complicated, but I think it's hopeless.
Well, I don't know. It's just it would take God to dream up the idea of God. So since I've got it, he must be there.
Well, something like that.
We miss any of his subtle pieces of reasoning there, Ron?
One or two. But a very important thing to realize here is that Descartes might have said the words that Ken said, but he wouldn't mean by idea quite what we now mean by idea.
Well, that's true.
So there's a medieval theory, a metaphysical theory behind his use of the term idea. So
I want to take us one step back, though, just really briefly, because there's another thing. There's a thing that Descartes gets out of this cogito argument kind of almost instantly. That always puzzles me. Not only he says am I certain that I exist, I know what I am, and I know what I am with certainty. I'm pure thought. I'm pure thought thinking itself. And I know I have a mind. I don't know I have a body. And then he's got this argument that, well, therefore I'm just a mind. I'm just pure thought thinking itself, disembodied thought. So that's this Cartesian dualism, the dualism of mind and body. I never get that, you know.
Well, there are a couple
steps left out there also.
Yeah.
So in meditation two, just after he goes through the passage in which he talks about his own existence, he asks, what am I? And he concludes that he's a thinking thing, that he is a thing that thinks. It takes a lot of argument, which he gives later on, to get to the conclusion that he isn't a body. But there is this argument, and in fact, he does believe that. He thinks that in arguing this, he's arguing for the traditional Christian doctrine that the soul can survive the death of the body. He doesn't think he's doing anything unusual.
Well, I agree with Descartes, actually, mostly through the second meditation. I think I exist, and I think I exist as a thinking thing. But we've got somebody on the line who is a little worried that even the cogito ergo sum may not be true. Michael, I'm talking about you, Michael in Sunnyvale.
Yes, I'm here. Listening to your program, and I've thought about this for many years and wondered why nobody ever questioned. The idea that I think, therefore I am, I think is really language-based. I think it really depends on a subject-verb context. I think there are some languages in the world that don't necessarily require that there be a subject just because it's a verb. Somebody said to me once that Hopi Indians might be that way. And the example that was given to me was, they don't say it rains, they just say rains, or raining is happening. And so it seems that you could have think without an eye that's doing the thinking.
You know, Michael, that's a very interesting thought, and it puts you right up there with some great philosophers, namely Lichtenberg and Wittgenstein, both of whom said, Wittgenstein quoting Lichtenberg, that Descartes had it wrong. If Descartes is really not sure of the existence of anybody else, he's got no reason to say I. He should just think, oh, here's some thinking. There's some thinking going on. And so even the cogito is already importing too much of what he already knew into his description of thought. What do you think of that, Ron?
Well, an interesting fact is that Latin is one of those languages in which there doesn't have to be a separate pronoun. So sum means, we would translate it as I am, but it's just a verbal form. On the other hand, there's thought. There's doubting going on. Could it be that the doubting is going on without a doubter?
Mm-hmm.
Well, even if there were doubting going on without a doubter, what we're trying to do is to address the doubts which Descartes raised about his own beliefs in Meditation 1. So the hypotheses that are in question, the hypotheses that are being challenged by cogito ergo sum, have his existence embedded in them.
But, but there's a great philosophical tradition, not just Wittgenstein and Lichtenberg. Almost immediately after Descartes, people started wondering, what is this Cartesian subject? I mean, Kant, that's a long time after Descartes, but he's worrying about the Cartesian subject, says, gee, I don't know anything about this Cartesian subject in a sense. I just have this bare I think, as he called it, the bare I, and he doesn't know anything about what its nature is, and it's certainly not some substance. And Hume said, I look inward and I see an impression of this, an impression of that. Where is the enduring self? I never get an impression of that, just a stream of ideas. So, I mean, it is fair to wonder whether we really can be so confident, as Descartes was, that there is this thinking subject, that it's a self-knowing substance, and that it is a substance at all. I mean, there's a lot of philosophical puzzlement about that.
Great questions. Let's get another question from the external world here. Neil in San Francisco.
Well, am I there?
Yeah, you're here. Well, I don't know. You're
well,
there.
We're here. I don't know.
Here. I'm here, and you're there.
You seem to be here.
I don't know that I really have a question as much as a comment. You know, about 40 years ago, I got interested in your friend Descartes, and I read some of his stuff, which is all kind of tough for a weak mind. But then I began to doubt. It changed my life.
Good.
I grew up in Salt Lake City. You know, I was a very devout Mormon. I did my 2.5 years as a missionary. And one day I said, wait a minute, maybe the whole thing is all wrong. And it took me a couple of years thinking it through without much help. I left San Francisco, Salt Lake City, moved to San Francisco, and I've been here 30 years, and I love it.
Well, that's great. That's great.
That's great.
That's a kind of a Cartesian experience I like to hear about.
Yeah, I was accusing Descartes of being possibly an overgrown adolescent because he carried this doubt extreme. That was tongue-in-cheek. But I do think there's something in Descartes, an attitude of critical self-reflection. You say, look, I believe these things, but on what basis and with what right do I believe these things? And can I really, once I do this exercise of critical self-reflection, justify my belief in these things? I mean, I do think that's an important attitude for us all to have, even in our daily lives, right? Even if we don't go so far as pure, utter, overwhelming Cartesian doubt.
And you know, it's not just...
There's this oddity in Descartes' life that he thought that what he was doing with this program of doubt was leading people to traditional Catholicism, not leading them to reflect critically on their heritages, but leading them to accept their heritage more fully. Europe at the time was almost entirely Roman Catholic. The church didn't see it that way. The church, like the caller, thought that if people began questioning their beliefs, they may be let out of the fold. And so he was always in trouble with the church. In fact, he's buried in unconsecrated ground and so on. Now, he didn't see himself as leading people to life-changing doubt. But this
That's
is an
because
oddity,
he
I think, in his philosophy. Yeah.
Is that because he thought that once you engaged in this doubt and this exercise of critical self-reflection, you would just confirm all this old stuff? So it was not revolutionary, but conservative in a way?
That's right. He was a very conservative thinker in a revolutionary way.
So in a way, he was defending reason against Catholic attacks on reason. I mean, at least I read that somewhere, that Descartes thought reason was okay, and it's not going to lead us away from religion. And so the Catholic fathers shouldn't be so skeptical about reason. Is there any truth to that interpretation of what Descartes was doing?
Well, certainly there are these arguments for God's existence that are supposed to lead people to a form of religious conversion.
Irvin in Oakland, what have you got to tell us?
Well, of course, that's a great line for me, because my question was, comment first of about the question of God. I think that's a matter of subjective spiritual evolution. Because in Sanskrit, the word for philosophy is darshan. What are you seeing? And everyone's going to see something according to their own individual level of spiritual development. Most people, frankly, even ourselves in the daily course of life, aren't even going to think philosophically, because they're just so materially absorbed, on the external realm.
Okay, that's very interesting. Let's bring it back to Descartes, though, now.
Okay, and the question is, how much was Descartes' contribution of, as you said, this analytical self-reflection, questions of subjectivity, the precursor to modern conceptions of psychology?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. Anybody want to tackle that?
I don't think it leads to anything that we might call depth psychology that we're familiar with from, say, Freud. All of that comes out of a different tradition, a Neoplatonic tradition. It has its ancient roots. But the Cartesian picture seems to be that what's in our minds is immediately available to us. Not that there's anything hidden in our minds.
But the tradition,
the mind is open to itself, completely right. Open to itself.
The 19th century tradition of introspective psychology was at least built to a certain extent on the conception of Cartesian dualism, right? That there's the physical world, and physicists examine that, and then there's the world of our minds, and we examine that through introspection, and then there's laws, psychophysics, between them. That's not a modern conception in the sense of 20th century. It's more of a 19th century conception, but it's very Cartesian in a way.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of René Descartes with Pitzer's College, Ronald Rubin.
Is it okay to accept some things on the basis of faith or gut instinct, or should you do what Descartes said, and once in your life at least, or maybe as a regular habit, just subject everything you truly believe in to Cartesian doubt and make sure you've got good arguments? Tell us what you think.
The number is 415-841-4134. More calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
How do you draw the distinction between the things that you think you know and the things that you are bedrock certain you actually do know?
I don't know that I've ever actually sat down and tried to sort them out. Because everything that I absolutely thought was bedrock that I knew has been demolished in my lifetime, so... So I'm ready to try to be very flexible.
On the streets of San Francisco, KALW's very own Ben Temption, the Diogenes of San Francisco, getting everyone to talk about Descartes. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, but we do question your existence. I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're looking at the ideas of René Descartes. Our guest is Ronald Rubin. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
And don't be shy if you're outside the Bay Area. Call toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Finally, you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
So I think of Descartes as a great moment, in a way, in the history of philosophy. Lots of people think of it as a bad moment, feminist theorists of certain kinds. They think of it as a bad moment because it's the moment when things became unstuck. I mean, Descartes wanted to get us out of this pickle that he put us in. But here's the pickle where, we're given our ideas immediately. The mind's open to itself, but nothing else. Everything else is a problem. God's a problem. Does he exist? The external world's a problem. Our bodies are a problem. Even other minds are a problem. I mean, and that's our pickle. Well, does he get us out of it? Can we get out of that pickle? I mean, what? Tell me what you think.
He didn't actually put the pickle in the jar. The pickle was already in the jar. And there was a mood of skepticism, a skeptical crisis, really, in Europe before Descartes. And he presents these thoughts in his works, but he says, I present them as the disease that I want to cure. So
right.
The jar is not of his making. I don't think he gets us out of the jar. But the
jar is not of his making, but it's of his crystallizing as a moment. I mean, at least as it comes, as we teach, you know, as we teach students about this philosophical pickle that defines the human situation. I mean, Descartes is a big focal point in trying to understand this pickle, at least. So he crystallizes the
pickle. I think you guys ought to clarify the terms of your debate. Is this a kosher pickle? Is it a dill pickle?
Yeah.
I mean, just what kind of pickle are we talking about here? Let's not get too abstract and flighty.
Yeah, that's true. Let's talk a little bit more about how Descartes proposes to get us out, and then whether we're really out and whether we could be out.
Okay, let me just interject an email comment that's really relevant here. This is from our friend Pete in San Francisco, often sends us good comments. Hi, all. John mentions a recent turn against Descartes. Can you talk about the key arguments of those who don't like Descartes anymore, as well as your counterarguments? So thanks, Pete. So go ahead.
Run. Take it away. Respond to whatever you want in that barrage.
Yeah. Descartes certainly is the bad guy these days. In the New Age literature, he's the opponent. This is partly because he distinguishes mind from body, and there's a movement now to think of mind and body as reintegrated, perhaps even as identical. It's partly because he is a major figure in the development of the mechanical philosophy that issues in Newton and a mechanical view of the world. I don't know that Descartes initiated any of these movements. I don't know that he should be viewed as the villain. Before him, for example, everyone in the church thought of the soul as possibly surviving the body. In fact, traditional views had it that the human being had three parts. At least Descartes only comes up with two. I don't really understand this focus on him as the source of modern error.
I mean, frankly, it seems to me that a lot of these things he got right. I mean, I do think that our brains or our minds, depending on how that turns out, are sources of contain information about the external world in virtue of the causal relation to it. And that Descartes articulated that. So there are books like Goodbye Descartes or Descartes' Dream, but
Descartes' Error.
Descartes' Error.
Yeah. No, but
don't put Descartes before De Horse.
Okay, let me speak on the behalf of those who want to demonize Descartes. I don't know if they want to demonize Descartes, but they want to demonize what they see as false presuppositions of the philosophy we inherit from that time. Anyway, I mean, they say, look, Descartes says we're first given our ideas and we're given the world as a problem. And they say, well, no, we're not just first given our ideas. I'm given the cup in my experience. I see the cup. I don't see my idea of the cup. I may have something in my head, an idea, a representation with which I see the cup, but I see the cup. I experience, Descartes makes the union between mind and body kind of mysterious, but I experience myself, they say, as an embodied being in the world, not first as a disembodied being, and then I have to get myself back into it as a problem. I mean, so then that's the kind of thing that people have in mind, right? They think Descartes divorced reason from emotion because emotion has to do somehow with the body, with embodiment, and reason is pure thought. But they think that's a mistake because emotions are kinds of thought, and they're tied up with, you know, kind of our whole being in the world or something. That's the kind of thing people worry about.
But you might say that, well, you know, Descartes was writing at a time when people had it was news to a lot of people that the earth moves in spite of what it looks like, namely that the sun moves, and that your senses do deceive you. So he,
that's true.
As Ron said, he didn't make all this stuff up.
No, that's true. That's true. No, actually, it's true. I think one of the things about the meditations is, I mean, he starts out distrusting the senses and all that. And by the end, he thinks he's put everything in its proper place. So the senses, for example, they may not tell you the real nature of things. Science and physics and reason tells you that. But they tell you what to pursue and what to avoid, you know, things that burn you. Avoid them. Things that give you pleasure, pursue them. And that's what your senses are for, to kind of be, you know. So now they're in their proper place, and we really understand what they can and can't do for us.
Let's hear from Arlene in Kensington. Arlene, are you there?
Yes.
What's your comment?
I know this isn't Descartes, but can you say something about solipsism?
Solipsism. Well, I think that's pretty Cartesian, the problem of solipsism. Ron, why don't you explain to us what solipsism means and then what Descartes thought about it?
Well, the solipsistic view is, I know I exist, but I'm not sure that anyone else does. Very oddly, Descartes doesn't talk about this. He says that when he looks out at other people, what he sees is their bodies, and he thinks that their bodies are not them, strictly speaking. The problem is right there on the surface of his writing, but as far as I can tell, he never talks about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. In a modern class on this, what you call it, epistemology class, you might say, well, you know, you've got two problems. You've got other things, but you've also got other minds. Once you've got the other people's bodies out there, how do you know they have minds behind them and you're not the only one? He doesn't really discuss that.
Well, there is an argument in a letter that kind of gets at this point, because he gives what he calls a morally certain argument that animals can't think, right? And that argument gives us a way to distinguish people and their bodies from animals and their bodies, because, you know, animals can't talk and they don't have a reason that he calls a universal instrument. They're good at this or good at that, good at this or good at that, but they have to be specially adapted for the things they're good at. And human beings seem to have this capacity, this capacity that's more universal, and they can talk. And that gives us some reason, and kind of morally certain argument that they're different from animals anyway.
Yeah, by the end of the Meditations, he's accepting things of which he's not perfectly certain. It's impossible, he knows, to live life without doing that. So he gives general rule. He exits the method. He leaves his method of Dad, and then goes back to ordinary life. And yes, he does believe that the fact that animals don't talk indicates that they don't have minds. He might well think that the fact that people do talk indicates that they do have minds. I don't know that he says that, but that suggestion. Yeah.
I want to interject with two emails here that are interesting. The first is just a hi from South Africa. Just returned from a talk at our Splinter Philosophy Cafe, and the topic tonight was Descartes and doubting. So thanks for that, Esther de Beer. And then this is from the same person, I guess. Did Descartes change his views later in life? Well, I don't know if later in life applies to Descartes. Tell us a little about the end of Descartes' life, Ron, and whether he changed his views.
Well,
that's
he died.
Actually from Joe. That's not from Esther, John. That's from Joe.
Oh, well, my pronounce is Esther. How do I know what's true? So go ahead, Ron, whoever
Descartes,
asked the question.
Okay. Descartes died in his 50s. In a group of intellectuals around Queen Christina of Sweden, and he was used to sleeping late and was forced to get up at 5 in the morning to tutor geometry and promptly died. Actually, the story is better than that. He was actually nursing a sick friend, caught pneumonia and died.
I think there's a lesson there for all of us. Stay in bed till noon.
Yeah, if you sleep late, keep doing it. You know, don't doubt your sleeping habits.
Apparently, he did most of his writing in bed, but that's another story. He did seem to change his views very slightly, but basically the same system is present in early works and late works. So the system is present in the Discourse on Method, which is he writes in the 1630s. It's present in the his last major work, the Principles of Philosophy, and it. Details change, but basically I think the view remains constant. It was revealed to him in a series of dreams, and it stayed pretty much the same.
Yeah, wasn't he struggling toward the end of his life to sort of get the mind and the body back together in proper relationship? I mean, he thought he understood the relationship between mind and body, but really working it out.
He struggles with it a bit more, I think, in the Meditations than it seemed from the conversation so far. As you point out, he talks about pain at the end of the Meditations and says pain is a fused mode of thought. And what it fuses is the idea of mind and body. That when we have pains, when we're hungry, we do experience ourselves, as you say, as embodied beings. Then later he writes, in the late work he writes, that a human being is... This is his phrase, a substantial union of mind and body. And if we understood what that meant, I think it would understand. It would mean something slightly different than he suggests in the meditations.
I think you're right.
I don't know exactly what it means.
Yeah, that's a rich topic. People are writing a lot about that these days. There's stuff for our listeners to explore.
A good place to start is with Descartes' Meditations. There's a lot of good translations, but I think the best one is by our guest Ron Rubin, which is available from Arete Press. Get it through Amazon or any place you want. Or unless you've got a better translation you'd like to recommend, Ron?
No, I think that's the best.
Okay. On that point of agreement, I want to thank Ron Rubin for joining us in a scintillating discussion about Descartes. Thanks a lot, Ron. We enjoyed having you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Our guest today has been Ronald Rubin. He's a professor of the history of ideas at Pittsburgh College, and he's working on a book called Silencing the Demon's Advocate. That's a book about Descartes' Meditation.
We also want to thank all the callers that we didn't get a chance to talk to and to emailers whose email we didn't get a chance to read on the air.
So, John, are you convinced that cogito ergo sum was an important thing? I mean, you were wondering at the top, why would anybody have to prove that?
Yeah, but I was just pretending. I've always thought that my existence was one of the most wonderful things the world had to offer. One of the most wonderful things the world has to offer me, at any rate. Yeah. And I enjoy my thinking, too. And I enjoy Descartes. I must admit, I've taught Descartes now for 40 years, and I think students, this old, long-dead philosopher from a different land, thinking he was doing one thing, defending the Catholic faith, and now being used by philosophy professors to induce doubt in all things held sacrosanct, students still love him after all these years.
You know, some people think, I mean, I'm no Descartes scholar, but I remember when I was an undergraduate being told that some people think that Descartes' conservatism was opposed because the church was, he really was attacking the foundations of religious belief, this, that, and the other thing, and he pretended to be defending it. Other people say he really was a conservative guy, but certainly the results of it, and you're right, the way the church took it was like, gee, this is an attack on the foundation. Faith is the foundation of belief, not rationality, not critical self-reflection. But, you know, I think critical self-reflection, even if the method of doubt doesn't work, critical self-reflection, that's one of the most important things in the world, in human life.
Yeah, and, you know, it shouldn't just be used by people that were brought up religiously. It should be used by people that are brought up scientifically. Whatever faith you're brought up in, secular humanism, Catholicism, Protestantism, Mormonism, Hinduism, read Descartes and at least have one Cartesian moment.
Yeah, there you go. And read our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is inspired by Descartes, cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog.
And now the life and times of René Descartes as told by Ian Scholes, our 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. René Descartes was born in a French village in 1596 and attended a Jesuit college where he excelled in mathematics. Later, he took a degree in law, which he never practiced, and served in the Dutch and Bavarian militaries. He achieved a great deal of fame in his time as philosopher, mathematician, a dandy, and a swordsman. In 1649, Descartes was summoned by the teenaged Queen Christina of Sweden to tutor her in philosophy. On arrival, he found that she wanted lessons at 5 a.m. every morning. Unused to the cold and the early hours, he liked to stay in bed until noon. Descartes caught pneumonia and died in Stockholm on February 11th, 1650. He was 54. He had spent the previous 20 years in semi-seclusion in Holland, thinking thoughts that make most people dizzy, asking himself, what do I know, and what does the knowing? For all he knew, life could be a dream. Reality could be a construct, kind of like the Matrix, foisted on him by an evil demon. He thinks he knows that a table has four legs, but how can he be absolutely sure? As Groucho Marx put it later, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? The only thing Descartes could be certain of was that there was a self that doubted his own eyes, hence his famous syllogism, I think, therefore I am. So his first self-evident truth was that of the self. The second was the existence of God. He finally concluded, quote, by God, I understand, a substance which is infinite, independent, supremely intelligent, supremely powerful, and which created both myself and everything else, if else there be, that exists. All these attributes are such that the more carefully I concentrate on them, the less possible it seems that they could have originated from me alone. So, from what has been said, it must be concluded that God necessarily exists. In other words, the self experiences the idea of the perfect being. The self, being less than perfect, could not have invented the idea of a perfect being, therefore the perfect being must exist. And would a perfect being deceive us? No. Therefore, the physical world also exists, because God willed it. And so the physical world dodged a bullet, thanks to René Descartes. I gotta go.
Wow, Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujin Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.